Oh hey cold dudes, welcome to the Blind Boy Podcast. And this week I'm going to open with a piece of short prose that was submitted by Hollywood actor Aidan Gillen. The ghost of Derek Davis haunts my sister's teeth. He controls her jaws from heaven. The only words that she can utter are the opening paragraphs of Derek Davis's Wikipedia page. And it is having a detrimental impact on her quality of life and mental health. She has lost her job. And sadly, last week, she was informed by the bank that her house would be repossessed. Her only response was, Derek Davis, left bracket, 26th of April 1948, underscore, 13th of May 2015, right bracket, was an Irish broadcaster, full stop. On television, comma, he co-hosted Live at Three, comma, presented Davis at Large and Out of the Blue, and won Celebrity Banished Door. That was The Ghost of Derek Davis Haunts My Sister's Teeth, submitted by Aidan Gillen, who is currently in quarantine, but is choosing to do it like a bat. So he's, Aidan Gillen is in quarantine, but he's doing it. He's hanging upside down with his hands over his eyes and refusing to see. He's become voluntarily blind and is operating using echolocation. So thanks very much, Aidan Gillen, for that piece of prose. It was beautiful. Lovely feedback from you for last week's podcast where I spoke to Dr. Michael Brooks about quantum physics. So thank you very much for the kind messages and all that. Carry on. So I often, you know, if you listen to this podcast, you know that I often romanticize genres of music. You know, I'm very interested in periods of music, like, you know, the disco in the 80s and fucking 70s disco. I'm always romanticizing the past and trying to wonder, what was it like? How class would it be to be in an early fucking disco where house music is just emerging in Chicago in the early 80s? Wouldn't that be incredible? And sometimes, you know, I might romanticize the early 90s rave scene. Seeing a band like the fucking Prodigy going to an all-night rave. So with the 90s, it's like, you know, I know people who would have been going to raves. Like, I was a child, so I obviously wasn't going to raves. So I went to a buddy of mine who was a DJ, and he would have been DJing in Limerick in the 90s. Now, the rave scene, Cork had a good rave scene in the 90s, I believe, but there would have been a bit of rave music in Limerick, and there would have been nightclubs where rave music would have been played. So I went to my buddy, and I said to him, what the fuck was it like? What was it like? What do you remember? It must have been incredible. And he paused, and he goes, to be perfectly honest, what I mostly remember is a strong smell of chicken burgers and a smell of chicken nuggets and people with curry sauce all over their hair. Now, that wasn't the answer I was expecting. You know, I'm there with bated breath expecting, oh, it was incredible. There was so much unity. The sound system was banging. If only I could go back to those times. And no, the answer was, when I was a DJ in Ireland, DJing at raves, unfortunately, I'm overwhelmed with culinary memories of fried fucking food and the smell of fried food and people with fried food in their heads and on their clothes. So, as you can imagine, that was quite a disappointing answer for me to receive. Because I'm thinking, for me, the answer I wanted was, you know, it's I think of the rave scene of the early 90s as people dancing, wearing fucking bright clothes, bright baggy clothes, banging tunes, everyone taking ecstasy. You know, almost like the 60s hippie movement, but a new techno version of it, you know? So it was a disappointing answer. But my disappointment soon turned to fucking intrigue. Because what do you mean your memories of being a rave DJ are mostly culinary memories? What the fuck is that about? I need some answers, buddy. And he gave me an explanation. And I didn't believe it at first because I figured he's deliberately telling me something fucking ridiculous, so I'll turn it into a hot take and put it on a podcast as fact. So I went googling his explanation about the relationship between curry sauce and fried chicken and these things, and why Irish raves in the 90s would bring up these memories instead of memories of music. And it turns out when I looked it up that like Fatboy Slim had the same experience when he DJed in Ireland during the 90s. Fatboy Slim was DJing at a rave in Ireland, getting on fucking great, banging out the tunes, and then suddenly everything stopped. At about 11:30, everything fucking stopped. And they start wheeling out curry sauce and chips and chicken. And no one's eating anything. The food is just there. And Fatboy Slim was just like, what the fuck is going on in Ireland with the raves and the curry sauce and the chips and the chicken? So what I ended up finding out was, in Ireland, up until the year 2000, if you legally wanted to run a nightclub, if you wanted to have a nightclub that stayed open late, you couldn't do it unless you provided everyone at the nightclub with quote unquote a substantial meal. So Ireland was presented with this unique problem whereby if you went to a rave, right, the nightclub is legally obliged to provide every single customer with a fucking substantial meal or else it gets shut down, and the meal was included in the admission price of going to the nightclub. So the Irish rave scene is strangely and uniquely different to the rave scenes of other countries. It's somewhat sullied, some might say. Like, you go to the nightclub, you're dancing, the tunes are banging, it's still the same tunes they have in the UK and they have over in America. The lights are bright, the sound system is loud, having a great night. Then 11:30 happens, everything's shut down for a half hour, and every single person is confronted and forced with mandatory chicken, chips and curry. Now, it's fair to assume that 90% of the people at this rave are taking ecstasy. This was, ecstasy was part of rave culture. If you're taking ecstasy, the last thing in the world you want to do is eat food. People are chewing the fucking jaws off themselves. Eating food is probably dangerous. So they're still being handed curry sauce and chicken and chips, and they're out of their mind on ecstasy, on a fucking love buzz. So people started smearing themselves with curry sauce on their faces. Or they'd get the fucking hot chicken in their hands and they'd be doting on yolks, pulling the chicken apart and feeling empathy for a fucking fried chicken breast and trying to shove it into their friend's mouth. But their friend's like, I'm on fucking yolks and I've got speed Mickey too. What the fuck do I want with this chicken? And they spit it out. So everyone was covered in chicken and curry sauce. And that was the rave scene in Ireland. Solid. A solid rave scene. Because of a ridiculous law. And they got rid of the law in the year 2000. But I just found that mad. That to go to a nightclub meant non-consensual chicken and chips. So I had to reassess my romanticised image and version of the 90s rave scene in Ireland. But if you listen to this podcast, you know that information like that it's what inspires kind of hot takes. And that information for me, it made me paralytic with the hot takes bubbling up inside of me. Because I see a connection now because of the mandatory non-consensual chicken and chips and curry of the Irish rave scene of the 1990s. I now see a connection between the Irish rave scene of the 1990s and 100 years previously. If you were an Irish person trying to go to a bar or a dance in New York in the 1890s, and I'll tell you why. If you were an Irish person in New York in the 1890s and it was late at night and you wanted to get yourself a drink, so, you know, 1890, New York, you're Irish, couple of decades after the famine, you're going to be pretty poor, probably a labourer if you're lucky to have a job at all, so you're going to go into a shitty enough bar, you're going to ask for a pint, and what would happen is, instead of a pint, they give you a rubber sandwich, right? Irish people in New York in the 1890s were sitting down at bars asking for drinks and instead being given a rubber sandwich. And the sandwich, like, it's made out of rubber and it's there in front of you at the bar. And you're not disappointed that the barman has given you a rubber sandwich because you know the crack. Your pint will come soon after. So the barman takes the rubber sandwich off you, gives it to the next person who asks for a drink, and then you get your beer. Or, if the sandwich wasn't made out of rubber, you were given a week-old, stale sandwich with mouldy bread. And one sandwich was made on a Monday, and it was passed to all the other Irish people in the bar in New York who asked for a pint. And I'm not making this up. It was known as a Raines sandwich. It was a cultural phenomenon of the 1890s in mostly Irish bars where there was one sandwich in the bar made out of rubber, or if it wasn't rubber, it was a week old, and if you ordered a drink, you were given the sandwich, you didn't touch it, you didn't eat it, then the sandwich was taken back and passed to the next person, and then you were given your drink. A Raines sandwich, it was called. A real thing. And why the Raines sandwich of the 1890s of New York and the mandatory non-consensual chicken curry of the 1990s rave scene in Ireland, why they're connected is it's because of the complicated relationship that Irish people and Irish culture has with alcohol. As a result of post-colonialism, of course I'm blaming the Brits, but the complicated relationship we have with alcohol and binge drinking. So in the 1990s in Ireland, you know, why bring in a law into nightclubs that say that you can only open late if you're serving food? It's a fundamental legislative distrust of the Irish people around that much alcohol. Like even today in Ireland, nightclubs, like, you won't find somewhere open past 3 o'clock if you're lucky. Most places close at 2. A distrust that we collectively have of ourselves around alcohol. The law in Ireland was called the Special Exemption Order, right? And it was brought in the 60s, the 1960s, I believe. And fundamentally, it comes down to, what do you mean you want to keep a nightclub open till 3 o'clock? You want to serve people, Irish people, drink until 3 o'clock in the morning? Sure, they'll go mad. The whole country will go on fire. No, we got to stop it. So you bring in this ridiculous, you try and stop people getting licenses by saying, well, you can only open till 3 if you're technically a restaurant. So the nightclub owners find a way around it by having this mandatory chicken and chips. But ultimately it comes down to the Irish can't be trusted with drink. And in 1890 in New York, the thing that led to this rubber sandwich that all the Irish people had to pretend to eat, this Raine's sandwich, it came from a thing known as Raine's Law. Raine's Law, right, which it was known as the Excise Law, was brought into New York in 1896, and it restricted how and when alcohol could be served. But at its root was an anti-Irishness. All right, like I said, 1890s in New York, the Irish were an incredibly poor immigrant community. I think 2/3 of every person in New York was fucking Irish. There was a massive moral panic about Irish immigrants, especially famine Irish immigrants, and Irish people were discriminated against massively and seen as a violent race of people who simply could not be allowed near alcohol or chaos would ensue. So in America, it's straight up anti-Irish prejudice, and in Ireland, it's an internalised prejudice that we have towards ourselves of, for me, it's a fear of freedom. We spend so 800 fucking years with the Brits telling us what to do, that when we're given the option of freedom, you know, a 24-hour nightclub, it's like, no, we can't have that much freedom. No, we'll go mad if we have that much freedom. Give us a little bit of freedom. Chicken sandwiches, mandatory curry, all right? We can't have full freedom. We'll go mad. So in New York, in the 1890s, a big thing in New York was saloons, right? Now, saloon nowadays, I think saloon, you know, when you think of a saloon, you think of the Old West in America, but New York had saloons. There was 8,000 saloons in New York, and saloons were the worst of the worst in terms of bars, you know, real fucking shitholes. Like, if you ever walk into a hipster bar and there's hay on the floor, do you know the way some places would put hay on the ground? Like, that comes from saloon culture. In the 1890s, there was no chairs, and you had your pint up against the bar. The reason there was hay on the ground is because people used to just piss on the ground. People would piss on the ground in a saloon, and you just put hay on the ground to soak up the piss like a fucking barn. But these 8,000 saloons were inhabited in New York by mostly very, very poor Irish people who were a discriminated, I don't want to say minority, because 2 out of every 3 people, but they were an ethnic group in New York who received massive discrimination. So the Republican Party wanted to shut down. They're like, how do we shut down all these shitty saloons that all the Irish are drinking in? So what did they do? They brought in this Raine's Law. And Raine's Law in 1896, the gist of it was, if you wanted to stay open as a saloon and serve drink, the annual license went up by, I think it was 10 times as much. Effectively placing saloon owners in a position where it's like, fuck, well, I can't turn over a profit with all these Irish labourers coming in if my annual license has gone up by 10 times as much. So they found a fucking loophole. They found a loophole. They stopped trading as saloons and instead became like private supper clubs. So when the Irish labourer in 1896 went in for his late night pint, he wasn't buying a pint. He was buying a rubber sandwich. He was buying food at the supper club, and the drink came with it. And that was the loophole. That's what happened. This anti-Irish law, they found a way around it through rubber sandwiches, just like the rave scene found a way around it in the 1990s in Ireland with mandatory, non-consensual chicken curry and chips. One of the other things that Raine's Law tried to stop, and this is one of the aspects of, we'll say, New York bar culture that's kind of problematic in the 19th century. So saloons used to have this, from like the 1860s onwards, they used to have this promotion known as the free lunch, right? And some people view it as almost like drug pushing. It was a way to turn mainly Irish labourers, new immigrants, into alcoholics. So the Irish that were coming from America were escaping the famine, escaping hunger. They were escaping a land where food simply didn't exist. So when they arrived in America, all the pubs, all the saloons would say outside, free lunch, free lunch. So the Irish would go in and it's like, where's this free fucking lunch? Are you giving out free lunches? And the saloon owner would say, yeah, there's free lunches. It comes free with a drink. So if you buy a drink, we give you a free sandwich, free food. And that's what happened. The Irish started going in for free food, but it promoted and developed a culture of drinking, of alcohol consumption. They're not going to, you know, there's no Irish deli, there's no Irish restaurants. It's go to the pub and buy the alcohol, buy the drink, and then you get your food because of it. It was also, a lot of these Irish people didn't speak English, they spoke Gaeilge. So they'd go to the pub to be with other Irish people. Not only that, unions became a thing. If you wanted a job on a building site, because a lot of building was going on in New York at the time and the Irish were involved in the building, you went to the pub for the drink to speak in Irish to the foreman, who was also Irish, to get a job. And it led to and developed a problematic culture of almost drug pushing alcohol in Irish people in New York. And Raine's Law was brought in to try and stop that. So it reversed it. Instead of buying a pint to get free food, you went in and bought a fucking rubber sandwich to get your pint. And if you've ever heard the phrase, there's no such thing as a free lunch, that's where it has its roots. It's like, there was no such thing as a free lunch. It's, no, you buy a pint and then you get the lunch, but you're still buying a pint. But in general, this, the free lunch culture and fucking Raine's Law and these saloons full of drunken Irish labourers was one of the driving forces that it would have fueled what was called the temperance movement at the time, which was a movement of socially, would you call them socially liberal or socially conservative? People who wanted to ban drink. And the temperance movement eventually led to, in the 1920s, the prohibition of alcohol in America. Drink was illegal in America. And you can trace the roots of the temperance movement, like I said, to these particular saloons. So this hot take is going to get even more bizarre and stranger. It's going to get more weird than rubber sandwiches and mandatory chicken at Irish raves in the 1990s. But before we go there, let's do our little ocarina pause so that an advert can be played. I've got my blue ceramic ocarina this week, which has a lovely range on it. Here we go.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yart. So that was the ocarina pause. an advert for some products. Also, I'm going to use this opportunity to remind you to support the Patreon for this podcast. Patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. As you know, if you've been listening, all my live income has been taken away as a result of the coronavirus. All my live income is gone. And I've been landed with a big load of debt because I postponed a gig in London. So I'm in a financial pickle. The Patreon is my sole source of income. I do this podcast for free, and you, the listener, support it via the Patreon page. But right now I'm just asking, if it's something you've been thinking about for a while, I could really use the price of a pint once a month, or the price of a cup of coffee once a month. Patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. And as always, if you can't afford it, you don't have to. You can listen for free. But if you can afford it, please do support the podcast. It's not far off the free lunch. Do you know? It's like, buy me a pint and you get a podcast for free. But optional, not mandatory, not forced on anyone. So back to the hot take, to the boiling hot take. So these rubber sandwiches that were being served in New York in 1896 in the saloons, these Raines sandwiches, the Raines law had unintended consequences. Instead of it stopping the amount of saloons, it meant that the saloons could keep serving as long as they were serving a rubber sandwich as well. And what happened is places decided to open up as hotels that served these Raines sandwiches, and it effectively meant that now there was no closing time. They were hotels serving rubber sandwiches, and you got a drink with the rubber sandwich, and it went on all hours, non-stop. So it made the initial problem that the Republican Party were trying to solve, it made it way worse, and now there was non-stop drinking. And as I mentioned before the Ocarina pause, the temperance movement, right? Now, the temperance movement in the 19th century was huge. This was a huge cultural movement that wanted to ban drink. It wanted to make alcohol in America illegal. And the temperance movement were using things like saloons and the debauchery of saloons and the violence that might happen, and an anti-Irishness and an anti-immigrant vibe too, to be honest. They used these things to push for prohibition, to make alcohol illegal, and to close the saloons. And the thing is, with prohibition people, obviously if you're involved in the temperance movement, it can be assumed that you yourself don't drink alcohol, you yourself don't go to saloons, you don't go to bars. So what became quite popular with the temperance movement were soda fountains, because people in the temperance movement still had to go somewhere. They're not going to go to bars, so they went to soda fountains. And the interesting thing around the culture of soda fountains in New York in the 19th century, a soda fountain was, it was a pharmacy that served fizzy drinks, basically. But in the 19th century, people didn't have fridges in their house. So the idea of going somewhere and getting a cold drink was a real treat, a real novelty. And a fizzy cold drink with flavours in it, even better. But like I said, soda fountains, these were in pharmacies, because for 100 years, carbonated water, or mineral water as it was known, it was seen as a medicine. It was seen as having medicinal properties. It wasn't like a recreational drink. Temperance people who thought that alcohol was evil would go to soda fountains in pharmacies to drink their fizzy drinks, because I think what it was is carbonated water does exist naturally. There's certain springs and fountains where, and it was known as mineral waters, where people would drink water from these springs that was fizzy, and they believed that it cured a lot of ailments. So they started making carbonated water from about 1800 onwards. This is why as well, like if you remember being a kid, you know, when you're at an Irish funeral, there's always an uncle who appears out of the crowd like a strange goblin. And if you're a child, they offer to buy you a mineral. You know, it's a uniquely Irish thing. We call our fizzy drinks like Coke and Fanta. Well, we don't. Uncles do. Irish uncles always say mineral. So if you've been a child at a funeral and you're Irish, it's a ubiquitous experience. A goblin-like uncle just arrives out of nowhere. The uncle you never speak to. You've no communication with him, but at a funeral and you're a child, they'll arrive and they'll just say, "Do you want a tin of mineral?" And I remember at a young age going, why the fuck is this uncle referring to Coca-Cola or Fanta or fizzy orange as fucking mineral? What is it? And you're intrigued because you're like, yeah, I think I do want a mineral, because what the fuck is that? And they never say it normally either. The uncle slithers through the crowd, tiptoeing, long fingers, goblin-like. "Would you like a tin of mineral? Would you like a tin of mineral? A tin of mineral?" Creating brand new vowels that are exclusively born into the mouths of slithery Irish uncles at funerals. "A tin of mineral. A tin of mineral." But that's why Irish uncles call it mineral, because it comes from mineral waters. They were seen as mineral waters that had medicinal properties. But let's go back to these temperance cunts in New York in the 1890s, and we'll say the early 20th century. They're all hanging around the soda fountains and pharmacies looking for their mineral water, you know, getting the horn off the medicinal properties of what they're drinking, you know, feeling superior to the sinful Irish immigrant down in the saloon getting drunk on alcohol, and they're in their soda fountain in their pharmacy. But the thing is, these early carbonated beverages, they were laced with heroin and cocaine. Like, there was a typical drink that they would have been drinking in around 1905 in New York in a pharmacy. It was like cocaine, cannabis and morphine in this fizzy drink. There was enough, I think it was like a tenth of a line of cocaine in one drink. So they were drinking this, thinking that it gave them pep. That's what, like, drinks that we drink today, like Pepsi, and the term pep. Like, Pepsi contained an enzyme called pepsin. Like, in the 18th century, when it was being sold in pharmacies as a medicinal drink, pepsin, which was a digestive enzyme. But I think it also had a lot of caffeine and cocaine in it. Dr. Pepper, another drink with 19th century origins in America, it didn't have pepper in it, it gave you pep. Coca-Cola literally had cocaine in it, like. It was literally just a drink of cocaine. It was invented by a fella called Pemberton, who was in the Civil War. He got addicted to morphine after getting injuries and developed this drink, Coca-Cola, to get off morphine. He made himself addicted to cocaine. So all these temperance people were drinking heroin, cocaine and hash in these soda fountains, thinking they were brilliant, and looking down their noses at the saloons full of Irish people getting drunk in New York. Now, things started to change a little bit with them. Like, people started to figure out that there was lots of people getting addicted to these cocaine drinks and stuff. So, flavour kind of ended up winning. And alongside these medicinal drinks that they were making in pharmacies, these carbonated fizzy drinks, the roots of what we now call fucking minerals. Here's another fucking mad thing, actually. I did a podcast on this before. Fanta, right? Just talking about the bizarre drug-laden origins of, like, Coca-Cola. And Fanta was made specifically for the Nazis. In 1940, there was an embargo on Germany because fucking Hitler was running Germany, and they couldn't, Coca-Cola couldn't send their syrup mix over to Germany, but they still wanted to make drinks for the Nazis. So the Nazis had access to a lot of orange, so they made Fanta for the Nazis. Fanta's a Nazi drink. So anyway, the soda fountain started to develop what we call soft drinks. They didn't have mad ingredients in them. They were becoming more about flavour and effervescence and how cold they were. The pharmacies that were making them, the people, the tenders, the bartenders or the pharmacists became known as soda jerks. And they started to make incredibly ornate drinks with like ice cream in them. And the roots of a lot of contemporary and modern cocktail making actually doesn't come from bars, but it comes from these pharmacies that were making mineral waters and carbonated drinks. And during Prohibition, because eventually the temperance movement won in America and Prohibition was brought in, I think it was 1919, these soda fountains became absolutely incredibly popular because now you couldn't buy alcohol anymore. But what did happen is when alcohol was being illegally served, they would take a lot of the techniques. Bartenders were taking techniques from the soda jerks because they wanted to make alcoholic drinks look like they were soft drinks. So if the police came in, you didn't look like you were drinking alcohol. It looked like you were drinking like a soda jerk drink, a soft drink. As well, a lot of the alcohol in Prohibition was homemade. Rot gut, it was known as. It could kill you. Homemade alcohol. So they'd use a lot of effervescence and syrups to disguise the disgusting flavour of the illegal alcohol. A lot of these soda fountains too, they were actually able to serve alcohol during Prohibition, but it wasn't called alcohol. It was like a tonic that had to contain alcohol. So there was this drink called Jake. Jake was the name for it. It was Jamaican ginger that had a load of alcohol in it. And people were buying this as a medicine from soda fountains. They were getting this Jamaican ginger, but it had about 80% alcohol in it, and getting pissed off it. But then the police found out that people were drinking this Jake, this Jamaican ginger, because there was alcohol in it. So in order to get around it, the manufacturer of the Jamaican ginger had to add another ingredient to it. And this ingredient turned out to be a neurological toxin. So people continued to drink the Jake drink, but they ended up developing a neurological disorder that affected their ability to walk. So you had all these poor people with a condition known as Jake leg from drinking adulterated Jamaican ginger from soda fountains. I'm gone on a tangent now. So anyway, let's take it back to 1890. And the reason I'm bringing up the temperance people going to these soda fountains as a way to shut down the saloons full of Irish immigrants, the great fucking irony of it all, one that I find anyway, it's carbonation and St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. Now bear with me here. So in these saloons where the Irish were eating the rubber sandwiches and the temperance movement were complaining about all the drunk Irish immigrants, okay? St. Patrick's Cathedral, which was built in Manhattan and finished in 1880, was hugely important for the Irish community in New York because they were all Catholics and it's St. Patrick and it was an Irish church. And it's like, if you're this disenfranchised group of people, to have this beautiful, huge cathedral that's an Irish cathedral in New York, morale-wise and for the Irish community, it's huge in 1880. And a lot of these labourers who were in the 8,000 saloons that were in New York, these Irish labourers who were getting the free lunch, getting the drink, being served rubber sandwiches, and also going to the saloons so that they could hold union meetings and get jobs in building sites, a lot of these Irish were actually building St. Patrick's Cathedral. And here's the bizarre connection between St. Patrick's Cathedral and the rise of soda fountains in New York, right? So the soda fountains that didn't serve alcohol but served fizzy carbonated drinks that the temperance people loved, the reason these soda fountains exploded all of a sudden from about 1890 onwards in New York, a big reason so many of them popped up is it was difficult in the 19th century to make water fizzy. They weren't getting natural mineral water, which had to be extracted from the fucking ground and required a specific spring to do it. The first attempts at carbonation in the early 1800s, they used to mix yeast with water and make it slightly fizzy. It wasn't very nice. But around 1810, they had a breakthrough where in order to make water fizzy and carbonated, if you got marble, right, the stone marble, and you mixed it with sulfuric acid and you put this into water, it created huge amounts of carbon dioxide, and that's how you made fizzy water. You got marble, mixed it with sulfuric acid, and you had fizzy water. And this is where a lot of soda fountains were getting their fizzy water. But that was quite expensive. But what happens in 1880? The Irish in the saloons are building this giant St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan for the Irish community, and they're building it out of marble. And there was so much marble being used to build St. Patrick's Cathedral that it flooded the fucking market in New York with marble. So all of a sudden the price of marble goes down to barely anything, because St. Patrick's Cathedral, think of it, they're making these blocks for the cathedral, so you have all this excess useless marble chippings, tons and tons and tons of it. Market is flooded, marble costs nothing. So all of a sudden what happens? They start building these soda fountains because it becomes cheap now, because you have all this marble from St. Patrick's Cathedral that you can mix with your sulfuric acid and make fizzy fucking water. So the point I'm getting at is the temperance people, who were trying to shut down the saloons full of drunk Irish labourers, who were going to the soda fountains to drink their heroin and cocaine fizzy drinks, the only reason they were able to do it was off the back of the labour of the Irish immigrants who were building St. Patrick's Cathedral for their community. So there you go. There's this week's roasting hot take for you. All right? That makes me want to have a little cocktail. Last week, at the start of the podcast, actually, I told you all about my cocktail recipe for the whiskey sour that you make out of chickpea juice. And loads of people did it and sent me their photographs of it on Instagram. So thank you so much for that. I was glad to see, first of all, that you believed me that it was a real drink. And secondly, to see so many people doing it and that you're enjoying it. Alright, I'll be back next week. In the meantime, look after yourselves. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Sneeze into your elbow. Stay the fuck away from other people. We're all going to be grand.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yart.